The Farming Programme with Arroquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham. For all your steel needs, call their friendly experts.
We've reports from cereals this week, including a chat with the CLA president. What do they want from the next government?
And we want answers about SFI, about sustainable farming. We want answers about ELMs, and we want answers about the agricultural budget going forward.
And we've a big announcement about Cereals 2025. We'll also hear about the work of TIA.
We provide an online platform so that farmers can access different knowledge, training and training providers, and we also do career support and labour market information as well.
Savills join us for the launch of their latest rural business spotlight. We look ahead to next week's groundswell, and Sean Sparling's here with a crop report and some timely agronomy advice. Plus, of course, the farming news, markets and weather.
The Week in Agriculture. This is The Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
Are we actually having a summer this year? Well, not this week. Hello, welcome to the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday, June 16th, 2024. I'm Steve Orchard. In the news this week, NFU Sugar and British Sugar have announced reforms to the UK sugar beet seed model, aiming to give growers more choice and flexibility. From next year, growers and seed breeders will be encouraged to buy and sell seed direct or via third-party suppliers, as well as the existing UK seed account, which will be modified. A new survey by Leaf has found that while nearly all the public think what farmers do is important, hardly any realise that farmers are responsible for looking after almost three quarters of the countryside. Perhaps we need to shout a bit louder. UK producers have, on average, recorded a profit of £16 a head on pig production in the first quarter of 2024, the fourth successive quarter of positive margins, but that followed 10 successive quarters of losses. Not such good news for the dairy sector, though, where deliveries for May were at their lowest level in 8 years, according to the AHDB. Sad news for Lincolnshire potatoes. Packer and supplier QV Realisations has ceased to trade following 2 years of trading losses. This has led to 200 redundancies, as there was no success in finding a buyer for the business. So, cereals last week, Lincolnshire show this week, groundswell next week, busy times, and with a flavour of the ninth groundswell, and first a bit of background to the principal of the show, welcome founder Paul Cherry.
Well, I suppose, yes, you're right, it started 9 years ago, and it started out of a sense of sort of frustration that the industry seemed to be sort of hell-bent on a very extractive form of farming. We all know we've got to eat food, and food's got to be produced from somewhere. But we just felt that possibly by taking our foot off the pedal on the industrial model without going mad, we could still look after our soils for future generations and hopefully make better food as well, grow it more cheaply, possibly store a bit more carbon. You know, there are a lot of positives out there. And it doesn't just happen. You have to really change the way you approach the whole sort of farming, your farming ethos, if you like. And so we wanted to create a show that was going to help people, not necessarily sort of change the way they do things, but change the way they think. And it's just been incredibly exciting because what started from tiny acorns has turned into this sort of monster. And people were saying, "Well, that's fine. You won't get." That many good speakers next year, and every year we're engulfed with speakers from around the world. Increasingly, end users are turning up more and more. They want to see what's happening with regenerative agriculture. So, yeah, we've created a monster, and we're enjoying enjoying the ride.
It's something that's grown and grown really over those 9 years, as you say. How many people did you get last year? Do you know?
We had about 7,000 last year. And this year we'll sell out at 8,000, but we're getting close to it already. So every year we seem to sell out. And so far, every year we grow. We don't want to get too big, but I mean, I think growing sort of 15% is a nice growth. We've certainly got space.
If you'll pardon the pun, it's growing organically, really, isn't it? Sorry, that was terrible.
Yeah, that's organically with a small O.
I mean, it focuses on regenerative agriculture principally, but what have you got going on this year? You've got speakers, you've got exhibitors, there will be stands, there will be sessions and so on. Give us a flavour of what we can expect.
Yeah, so we've got more tents. So there's 10 speaker tents, including the big top, Charles II, 4,000 people. We've got, in terms of sort of big names in our world, I suppose, there's a fellow who's never spoken in Europe before, John Kemp, who runs a one of the biggest regen podcasts over in America. So he's a very big name. Adette Menard coming from Canada, Benedict Bozell. But principally, the Americans make great, they're great thinkers and great speakers. But we realize that they can be speaking a foreign language. So principally, if you go to the website, you'll see that most people are UK-based. So we, you know, much as we enjoy flying people in across the water, we actually realize that farmers want to hear their own language being spoken. And there is, you know, there's so much that's relevant to us that we need to, you know, we need to be concentrating on the sort of home turf, if you like. Hmm. The principles are great when they're spoken in America, but actually people want to drill down and hear locals who are speaking the language they really understand. But the soils that they understand, you know, our soils are very different from a prairie soil, and our weather is very different from the prairie or from Australia or Canada or, you know, Argentina. So, you know, we do realize that it's about UK ag, even though there'll be people, a lot of our delegates will fly. Last year they flew in from all five continents. You know, we have a big reach in the sort of regen world. And just while I'm on regen, I mean, regen agriculture is a word that's, you know, it's only a few years old, and we've got to try and understand exactly what it means. It's changing and it's evolving. And it's also, dare I say it, the words are being slightly overused by some people in the retail sector. So we've got to be careful that we sort of manage regen, if you like, that it doesn't just become one of those sort of greenwash words that the consumer doesn't understand, and possibly the farmer doesn't understand either. You know, so,
would it be fair to say, Paul, that you're not trying to ram all this down people's throats, but give them the opportunity to have the information, think about where they go next?
Absolutely. It's a slightly corny expression, but we call it a festival of ideas. You know, you can come to Groundswell and buy a drill for 120,000 quid, or you can just go to amazing sessions and meet amazing people and eat amazing food and hear amazing music, and drink amazing beer and stay up late and behave like an idiot, or you can go home early. You know, we offer a full sort of festival experience, and it seems to be going down really well. And I think that's why it's growing. People want to perhaps have a different experience from what they're used to at the sort of agricultural shows that have been running over the centuries. And
Glastonbury for farmers.
Thank you for that. that word does get kicked about a bit. It's not quite Glastonbury because the music isn't that loud. You can still speak over it. You know, we get a very different demographic from the average agricultural show, if you like. You know. So I suspect that's why it gets dubbed the Glastonbury of farming. I get as much satisfaction out of seeing people striking up a conversation in a queue for a cup of coffee as I do to hearing amazing speakers, you know, sitting on the stage. For us, it's an extraordinary meeting of minds of people who are way down the journey and people who are just starting.
Absolutely. And you've got lots of speakers, lots of sessions taking place over the 2 days, lots of exhibitors. Just remind us then, Paul, where and when and where do we go for all the necessary information?
Well, thank you very much. Go to groundswellag.com. That gets you into the website. Everything's on there, all the speakers, all the sessions, all the exhibitors, all the drills. It's at Lanark Manor Farm, which is just off the A1 in Hertfordshire, 26th, 27th of June, so it's only in 2 weeks' time. Look forward to seeing as many of you as possible can come.
Fingers crossed for the weather, fingers crossed for the traffic, and a couple of brilliant days, Wednesday 26th, Thursday 27th. Another Groundswell, number 9. Thank you, Paul, for your information. Thanks for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning.
Great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
At Cereals the other day, I caught up with CLA President Victoria Vivian, and the conversation inevitably turned towards the upcoming election and not getting political. I wonder what the CLA are looking for.
Well, I think we're all looking for the same thing. Whether we're rural or urban, we want some straight, honest talking from our candidates. We want them to turn up and we want them to tell us what they think and what they'll do, and then we will decide what we're going to vote for. I think there seems to be a lot of second guessing about what we want going on, but that's, we know what we want. And we want answers about SFI, about sustainable farming. We want answers about ELMS, and we want answers about the agricultural budget going forward.
Yes, there doesn't seem to have been an awful lot of detail, or doesn't seem to have been any detail really, in terms of policy manifestos dealing with agriculture and the rural economy.
I think you have to go to your own candidates for that one, because we're not getting any details at all at the moment. We haven't had manifestos from the two main parties, and we're crossing our fingers. We're travelling more in hope than expectation, I think, that we will get that agricultural guarantee budget for agriculture in excess of four and a half billion, which is peanuts compared to the money they're spending on everything else, and yet the results can change our world.
You have a bit of a list as to what the CLA would like to see, starting with, you talked about a contract with the government. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the past, when we were still part of the European Union, people were receiving a basic payment. We at the CLA have been arguing for some time that that is a very volatile and difficult thing to maintain across parliaments. And so we've been really powerful supporters of the ELMS project. That is a contract with government over 3 years or 5 years, where we will deliver something for the public good and for the taxpayer. And the most important thing about that is they can't wriggle out of the contract.
Yeah, there's always this danger with anything political, is that farming being a long-term planning business, if you've not got a contract, the political side could change it at a whim, really, couldn't it? And if we have an election, change of government, they decide to go in a different direction, the farmers are left high and dry.
Well, I think we have had indications from the shadow team that they are keen on the ELMS project as a whole. I think we have their support for SFI, or at least we have had it in conversations. I think that the extension of that is whether or not, if you had a basic payment, a government which is going to be very, very tight for money will start to cap that payment or withdraw it altogether, which unfortunately is what happened in Wales. So I think there is precedent for capping, and the Treasury cuts with a sharp knife.
But also, when you're talking about rural economy, you were bemoaning the lack of connectivity where you are, but it's a general thing in all rural areas, isn't it? We're expecting farmers to run as a business, and a fairly sophisticated business, with 3G phone signals.
I only used us in the southwest as an example. I'm quite aware of the fact that it's everywhere that this is a problem. We simply can't function as a business without connectivity, and that's connectivity across broadband, but also connectivity for phones. It is absurd to even begin to think that we could function, as you said, as sophisticated businesses, high-tech businesses. We want to be the dynamic future of farming, but I'm afraid that government sees us as the Ladybird Book of farming.
Lovely. And planning, of course, is always top of the list. Planning, but not just for farming, but for residences on the edges of villages, for instance.
Well, we can't really grow our businesses unless we can staff them properly. We want the economy in the rural areas to grow properly as well. We need housing. The CLA campaigns for a small number of houses in a large number of villages. We want lifelong living communities, so where teenagers can move out of their home, where they can buy their first family home, and ultimately where they can downsize so they can let somebody else fill a family home. And we're not seeing any of that at the moment.
Planning still seems to be a difficult exercise, doesn't it?
Well, when we asked a lot of members the question, what do you think is holding up planning, I'm afraid a lot of them said NIMBYism, because people don't want to see development in their village. They'd quite like it to be conveniently somewhere else. But properly managed, well-planned growth of villages will only increase the sense of community in them. We want a school, we want a pub, we want a shop.
Simple as that, really, isn't it? Just going back to the election, just to wrap up, there's a good chance we're going to have a whole raft of brand new candidates or brand new MPs after the election, who maybe don't have that much experience either in Parliament or with the rural economy. Are you recommending CLA members and people in the rural economy and agriculture generally to get in touch with these people now and make sure they know what we need?
Well, first you'd have to get past the wall of advisors that they have around them who'd rather they didn't speak to us. But we have at the CLA our Unlocking the Potential of the Rural Economy candidate pack, and we have sent it out to probably about 1,500, 1,800 potential candidates. So that's a really good starter for 10 on the rural economy. And then after the election, we will also be getting in contact with all the new people and saying, would you like to get together with the CLA to talk about the rural economy? So we hope to be able to share the knowledge and the information.
And farmers can hopefully influence these candidates, can't they, before the election? Because it seems to be that people are going to vote local. Now's the time to be getting in touch with the candidates to find out what they're going to do.
Well, I think they need to turn up. There have been a few occasions where candidates haven't turned up for important things like county shows because they're worried about facing, I think, maybe they're worried about facing 250 farmers in one room. We're not that frightening. So I'd like them to turn up every place possible and be honest about their knowledge or their lack of knowledge. And we will be honest about how we can help.
Victoria, thank you so much for that, for talking to us on the Farming Programme this morning, and enjoy the rest of Cereals.
I'm really looking forward to it.
With all these potential new MPs, now has to be the time to make contact and make the case for farming. Time to head to the fields. How are the crops doing? What should we be doing to them? Time to welcome our crop doctor, independent agronomist Sean Sparling. Morning, Sean.
Yes, morning, Steve. Short and sweet this week, mostly because of the weather and, of course, the time of year. Things are at that stage now where the wheats are flowering pretty widely, so their last fungicide is going on if it's not already been applied. So the wheats, at least, are now starting to head towards harvest as far as spraying goes anyway, because this will be the last pass unless there's more in the way of foliar nutrition to deal with, and I wouldn't put anything past this year. Things still very complicated because of the continuing unsettled, wet, windy weather holding us off many of these spraying jobs, not to mention that deluge at the beginning of this week. Very variable as ever. I took 24 mil of rain overnight into Monday, then another 8 mil on Monday into Tuesday. You know the story, you've all been wet anyway. Since we last spoke a week ago, I've taken well over 40 mil of the wet stuff. Variable, as I say, but everybody finds themselves once again with tickets stacking up and either too windy or too wet to travel. Perfect conditions for our old friend Septoria to remind us, as if we need reminding, at the end of such a relentlessly tough season, just how destructive a disease it can be. So watch this space. So starting with sugar beet then, moving like a train in many places. The mid-March drillings already meeting across the rows for Lincolnshire Show. Never mind in the row for Lincolnshire Show. Plenty of fields drilled mid to late April and beyond. Still looking a little bit moth-eaten and scrappy. Herbicide effects noticeable this season, as we've been saying for a couple of weeks. But it appears largely transient, and a bit of sunshine and warm on top of this wet stuff will change things dramatically. Manganese, magnesium, nitrogen, sulfur, sodium deficiencies, not hard to find. So taking the opportunity to correct those on days when it's not possible to get herbicides on as that fine spray may be a very good idea. Always best to stay ahead of nutrient deficiencies in any crop, but in particular in sugar beet at this stage. As far as weed control goes in beet, mostly pretty successful, but there are always those fields where the weather has led to intervals between herbicide applications being stretched from that preferred 9-10 days into 18-19-20 days plus. And in those fields, the bindweed and the fathen in particular has flourished. But just watch the total combined doses of things like ethafumisate. You can apply a kilo of ethafumisate per field per 3 years. Maximum individual dose, 0.6 of a litre. Fenmedifam, another black bindweed active, maximum of 6 litres of product per field per year, maximum individual dose of 160 gram fenmedifam, 3 litres per hectare. Lenacil, maximum individual dose 0.4, maximum total dose 1 litre. So restrictions on total amounts becoming very relevant as these crops start to close in and multiple applications are being made. More so where crops are shifting and the weeds are getting big, where these treatments were delayed, as I say. So just speak to your advisor and make sure you're not only crop safe with these mixes, but also that you're staying legal. Sugar beet now widely at 10 leaves or more, so the threshold for Mises persicae then falls to one nymph per plant, and I think we're unlikely to see much more in the way of adult migration, or so I'd hope. So as we know, when aphids and virus comes in after this 10 to 12 leaf stage, the plant's inbuilt resistance mechanism kicks in, and the severity from virus that does come in now significantly reduced over the earlier infections. So let the beneficials do their job now, I think. Plenty of ladybirds out here to do their bit, plenty of spiders, birds, all ready for a meal of spatchcock Mysis persici. Crop damage being reported where the intervals, by the way, between broadleaf weed herbicides and clethodim in particular are not being observed. So speak to your advisor about those. It's a crop safety thing as well as an efficacy thing. Peas showing manganese deficiency very widely, and important to treat that as soon as possible in peas. Manganese deficiency causes marsh spot, and that's where the heart of the pea goes brown, and it can cause significant yield penalties as well as ruining the sample. Very cheap and easy to treat. First flowers in combining peas for me, so the first fungicides for Mycosphorella, botrytis, grey moulds, etc. going on now, along with manganese and magnesium. Pea moth numbers vary, but if you've caught 10 moths in your pheromone traps on two consecutive days, then they'll need treating. Go to the pgro.org pea moth app to tell you the optimum timings for treatment based upon those dates that you found those thresholds. Spring beans flowering as well now too. Optimum timing for that first fungicide when the first pods are setting. But with the weather perfect for downy mildews, botrytis, chocolate spot, make a call on your own farm as to the best start timing. Staying ahead of the disease is your priority. And as we saw last year, when we get weather conditions so far away from the norm like we're in now, your gut instinct probably more reliable than any other books. Spring cereals racing through the growth stages as well. Growth stage 30 to growth stage 45 in as little as 12 days on one of my farms. So watch the growth stage if you've got tickets with growth regs in them that may have been delayed. Herbicides as well. Just watch those latest safe timing. Wild oats seem to be flushing at least once a week at the moment in wheats and spring barleys in particular. Fields treated a couple of weeks ago, filling up again from below to have just as many, if not more, than were sprayed for a couple of weeks ago. Watch the total doses, the maximum numbers of applications allowed, the growth stage cutoffs for all of those graminicides though. Blight in the potatoes continues to frustrate. 7-day intervals between sprays in these conditions, absolutely crucial. Smith periods and Hutton periods being exceeded every day at the moment. Weed control pretty good though, so that's something I suppose. For those with maize, the cool wet weather and the plants trying desperately to put on rapid growth is showing up significant levels of purpling in the leaves. Phosphate and potash deficiencies widespread, so make sure any deficiencies are dealt with before you go applying any herbicide to these maize crops. Also worth remembering that a leaf isn't a leaf in maize until there's a definite collar fixing it to the stem. The first leaf's got a rounded tip as well. So with things like mesotrione, fluroxypyr, nicosulfuron, just check the latest and earliest safe timings and check for yourself. As a rule of thumb, the plants will be 6 to 8 inches tall at 3 to 4 leaves, but do make sure you check properly. So Lincolnshire show almost here, and for anyone who went to Caythorpe Agricultural College between 1983 and 86, Paul White, Chalky White, has organised a reunion to meet up at the Brown & Co stand at 1 o'clock on the Thursday afternoon. Be great to catch up there if you can. Me and Andy Mitchell will be there, but don't let that put you off, will you? Right, that'll do. Continues to be wet, windy, sticky, cold, troublesome, annoying, just delete as applicable. So see you at the show and let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Thanks, Sean. More from Cereals on the way, including a look at the work of TIA, the Institute for Agriculture and Horticulture, Savills' latest rural business spotlight, and a big announcement about Cereals 2025, plus the markets and weather.
The Farming Programme, with Araquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, supplying the region for over 40 years.
This is the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday, June 16th. I'm Steve Orchard. At Cereals last week, Savills launched their latest rural business spotlight. And with a summary, here's Associate Director Andrew Teenby.
Yes, we launched our Food and the Environment spotlight, which we were using to look at the challenge that farmers are really facing at the moment, which is how do they respond to the challenge of producing food for a growing population at the same time as reducing their impact on the environment and helping towards environmental recovery and the reduced climate impact as well.
Is it feasible to carry on producing food profitably and still benefit the environment at the same time, or are they kind of mutually exclusive?
I think they have to be achievable together, and the changes that have happened to the Sustainable Farming Incentive Scheme this year are a big step forward in terms of helping that become a reality, really. We're seeing a big step up in support for that.
You're saying in the report that a big increase in food production is required, yet SFI seems to be almost encouraging farmers to take land out of food production. How do they work together?
Yeah, I mean, so that the DEFRA has actually changed the SFI this year by capping 10 options so that farmers can use them over no more than 25% of their farm in total. So they're sort of responding to that need to make sure that food production remains. It is clearly a challenge, though. You know, we know that we've got a growing population. They need food. And there's also this, you know, land use questions in terms of the environment and other uses of land. I suppose partly there's questions over the difference between food and feed. And, you know, are we better off producing the meat that we need from grass-fed systems that are using land that is best used for that purpose and using less grain to feed animals? And sort of so I suppose the amount of calories you need versus the amount of food are not necessarily the same question, really. But yeah, I suppose there's going to be some changes, and it's a delicate balance, really.
Talking of changes, of course, one of the big changes we've got coming up in not too distant future is government. We're not going to get political. I'm not going to ask you for which one's best or anything like that, trust me. But what do we want to see from whatever the next government might be?
I think from an agricultural productive farmer's perspective, we're already going through a major change with the agricultural transition. So an additional amount of change for political reasons on top of that is probably not something that the industry needs right now. So it's probably a degree of continuity of that trajectory that we're already on. And I would expect that the Sustainable Farming Incentive, for example, is quite a flexible platform in terms of you can add options, you can vary the payment rates. So actually, if there is a change of government, it's something that can be worked with rather than necessarily something that needs major change.
So a bit of continuity would be a nice thing. So we have seen an awful lot of change in farming over the last 5 to 10 years, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Yeah. And I think, you know, it is a long-term industry, and so, yeah, continuity would be appreciated. And at the same time, I think really some knowledge of kind of the strategy or the plan that isn't affected by political cycles. But that's probably wishful thinking, really. But in reality, that's, you know, when we're talking about farming, we're talking about nature. They're long-term processes with long-term impacts and implications. So the longer we kind of know what our path is, the better, really.
Yeah, we need to have some planning time, don't we, within farming? Because, as you say, it's not exactly something you can change in 6 months.
No.
Big headline on the report is, how do we increase agricultural productivity? Is this like the universal panacea? How can I make more money from my farm? There's some top 10 tips, if you like, aren't there, within the report?
Yeah, so we looked at the... So DEFRA's got the... Farming Equipment Technology Fund that gives quite good grants against technology. So we looked at what was proving popular in that, then further down the line of what other technology could be coming forward. I think in terms of what farmers are getting at the moment, if you looked at the ones that we've classified as ag tech, they tend to be livestock related, really. There's things like heat detection equipment, slurry scrapers, silage pushers, those kind of things tend to be proving really popular. I think on the arable side, we can see technology sort of further down the path that will be adopted at some stage but isn't really there yet. And then I guess we have technology like GPS and such like already quite well adapted in that sector, really. So there are things coming, and they will help with productivity, and that has to be part of the answer, really. But that's no different to the history of the industry, really. When you reflect back over the last 100 years, you know how much it's changed, and it will continue to do so.
But it is all really about technology of one form or another, isn't it, to improve productivity?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I mean, there's the electronic kind of technology side, as we've just spoken about, and then also the biological side as well, whether that's traditional plant breeding, whether that's gene editing, using the, I suppose, more relaxed regime around changes that could have been achieved by traditional breeding, and sort of moving that through into sort of productive agriculture, wider adoption as well.
Can farmers afford to switch to regenerative farming? Now, there's a headline that could be discussed for many hours, never mind just a few minutes. But what's your take on that? There's arguments for change, there's arguments against change. Surely, to a certain extent, farmers have always been regenerative. They have to be, otherwise they wouldn't have any land left.
I think, I mean, if I look at my own farm, our soils got heavier, our soils got tougher over the years, which I would say is the, you know, a reduction in organic matter, because it used to be grassland ultimately, so it's still moving towards an equilibrium with less organic matter in it, and ultimately that makes it harder to work. So I guess if you look at, you know, a sustainable system as being one where there's, you know, there's no improvement, but there's not necessarily a decline, and regenerative looking to improve, then certainly in my case, it's not regenerative, but there's elements of a regenerative type practice that we're building in there, and there's probably more we can do really. And I think that's part of it really. There's a lot of talk around regenerative agriculture. There's some people who that's purely their focus and that's the kind of system they're putting in, but you step back from that and it's a collection of five or six principles, depending on which list you use. You know, they can be integrated into a system one by one, and so it's not necessarily a wholesale change, it's practices that will help. So I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think, you know, there's a general direction of travel towards lower carbon, lower environmental impact, so a lot of that is consistent with regenerative anyway, so I think it's kind of the direction of travel.
It seems to be the direction of travel in a lot of cases, but from a purely business point of view, is it viable?
So we did a modelling exercise using our virtual farm for this spotlight report, and essentially what we did there is we looked at a conventional system and did a budget for that with assumptions around the rotation, the sustainable farming incentive options you would pick, and then we did a second model, which was our regenerative model, and for that we looked at again the rotation, the SFI options you would pick, we looked at some regenerative premiums for products, and we also looked at some carbon credit income, and put that together and looked at what the year one impact was and what the year six impact would be as you sort of moved through a transition. And what that showed us was that in that year one, so when you've just switched, you're getting some yield impacts, and yes, you can make some cost reductions, but not perhaps as significant as you could later on in that process. So in year one, there was effectively a cost, which in for the scenario we modelled, we put about a 10% reduction in margin in that year one position. As you move through to year six, it was a 31% higher margin relative to conventional agriculture. And that's essentially been achieved through some yield recovery, a degree of cost reduction, but also they're quite different in terms of the environmental income streams that they're bringing in. There's obviously a lot more SFI options that can be used in the regenerative system. There's the new no-till option, which is £73 a hectare. There's the new variable rate fertiliser spreading option, which we used in both systems. That's £27 a hectare. So there's quite a bit more income on that regenerative side. So it was something like, I think, £49 a hectare net income from the environmental income streams on that side versus about £250 a hectare in that regenerative system. So it was more dependent on that income stream, but looked positive. So that was what the model showed. It's going to vary from farm to farm in reality, because some soils will adapt to a direct drilling based system a lot easier than other soils. So the model's indicative, but yeah, it showed that the economics, you know, the options that have come on stream this year compared to last year for the SFI really do help.
It's obviously a long-term thing, as is all farming, let's face it. If you're going to switch from one system to another, you've got to expect a bit of a hit to start with. But it's still, you go back to sort of the previous regime, even moving to regenerative and SFI payments and so on, it's still relying on payments from the state of one form or another, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, we did have a bit of regenerative premium in the model, but it was on a crop that was probably about 8% of the farm area, so when it goes through to the end, it doesn't have the largest impact. There's probably a bit more potential to have built that out. There's a few premium schemes available there, so that kind of approach could expand and give some additional funds. We've also got an awful lot of other businesses in the food chain, whether that's supermarkets or processors, declaring that they want their farmers to reduce their carbon footprint and practice regenerative type principles. At the moment, it's not entirely clear how many of them are willing to back that with kind of investment back in their supply chain and funds to help farmers achieve that. But I think that's going to be something that's going to be, you know, hot on people's radar over the next couple of years, really.
Andrew, this report was launched at Cereals the other day. If somebody wants to have a read of it who wasn't at Cereals, where can they get hold of a copy and how could they discuss it with somebody?
So all of the reports that we publish from the research team are published on our Rural Knowledge portal, so you can find that on the internet. And alongside that, there's contact details for my team, and also on the report, there's contact details for our professionals in the food and farming team as well.
So Savills Rural Knowledge portal is what we're sticking Google.
Yes.
Andrew, thank you very much. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning.
Thank you, Steve. It's been great to be here.
It is a very detailed spotlight report, definitely well worth a read. One more thing from Cereals for this week. While I was there, I grabbed a coffee with Tess Howe, Head of Partnerships and Policy at the Institute for Agriculture and Horticulture, known as TIA, to find out who they are and what they do.
And we're a new professional body for farmers and growers across the UK, although focused on England at the moment. And we provide an online platform so that farmers can access different knowledge, training and training providers. And we also do career support and labour market information as well.
So this is all about learning, education, development, CPD, that kind of thing.
It's exactly that. Farmers are already really professional, so we're not here to professionalise the industry, we're here to provide that recognition. So farmers can do their training. If they do it on our platform, it automatically sets up a training record for them so they can demonstrate all of the activity that they do, not just that formal training, but all those farm walks, all that knowledge exchange that we know is really important to farmers, but they don't get the recognition. So we can do that, or you can upload your external records as well.
So if farmers are professional and they do all this anyway, why do we need you?
I think we all know how much the world is changing right now, and farming ever so much so. It's about keeping on top and getting that recognition for what you've already done, but also helping you move forward with all the changes in policy, with environmental changes, and consumers as well want to know what's going on. So it's about that evidence, and it's about keeping you on the front foot.
So it's administering training that's already being done, but you offer training as well yourselves.
So we only offer some online what we call essential skills. Everything else we signpost out to training providers. There's a brilliant network of training providers in the country already. We're not here to take over their job. What we want to do is increase the demand for that training and really help people find them a lot easier than they currently are doing. So our online essential skills focus on health and safety, animal health and welfare, biosecurity, farm finances. We're just doing a nutrient management one, succession, inclusion. It's all those basics that help you be a good farmer that you might not get elsewhere, but you can go on and do more learning afterwards as well. I mean, our platform brings together a lot of learning that's already out there, so I like to refer to it as the Netflix of training. It knows who you are, the role that you've got, and the place in the country that you operate, and then it provides that information that's most relevant to you. So you can still find all the information. You could be a wheat grower in Lincolnshire, but actually you can still find out about cauliflower growing in Cornwall. It's just that's not going to be prominent for you, so that it saves that time and removes the barriers that we know farmers have.
So there are plenty of benefits for the farmer. What about for the individual?
For the individual, I think it's really important now that you can demonstrate all of the good work that you have done. We're finding with the next generation, they see accreditation, they see their friends getting letters after their name and being professional because they're an accountant or a surveyor, and actually they want that as well. So this is a way of getting that for them as well.
So, yeah, more than just passing on the knowledge from mum and dad, which has been the way it's been done for most of generations, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And I think it's really important that they're still really important skills, but we are moving forward and the world's changing the way we do things. I mean, Cereals today, we're learning lots of different things about how we can do what we've traditionally done in one way, and now we're looking at completely different ways. So it's really keeping on that front foot.
And it's a membership-based system, so there's obviously a cost to this.
There is a cost. We think it's very reasonable. At the moment, there's an introductory offer. We only launched membership in January. So for £77, you can become a member of TIA. You have full access to our platform. Everything's there. You do those online courses. You get certificates for them. You can record any training that you do. And then when you've got an assurance visit or a supply chain coming around, then all those records are there for you and you're not scrabbling around your desk.
All right, Tess, where could we go and find out more information about all this?
So we're online. So it's tiah.org. As simple as that.
Lovely. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you very much.
There's more from the exhibitors at Cereals next week, but before we look at the markets, we have one important announcement about next year. Andrew Ward's on the line. What have you got to tell us, Andrew?
Yes, it's very, very exciting that I am delighted to say that on the 11th and 12th of June next year, Cereals is returning to Lincolnshire, but not only is it returning to Lincolnshire, It's returning to my farm at Lednam, which is fantastic news.
Excellent. So we won't have all the problems with travel that we all had on Wednesday and Thursday last week.
No, I hope not. A lot of roadworks down that way, down in Hertfordshire this year. We've hosted it twice before. A lot of changes in farming since those days. It was 2004, the first time we had it, and 2008, the second time.
It's returning to its spiritual home, isn't it, really? The home of Arable, back in Lincolnshire next year. Brilliant news.
That's what I've heard one or two people say, which is, you know, Lincolnshire is known as the breadbasket of the world. Not only England, of the world. And so for the series events to come back here is just fantastic news.
Any changes planned next year already, or have you got a lot of work to do before that?
We've got plans to alter the layout of the site. As I was going around over the 2 days, I was making notes on what I thought needed to change. I was talking to farmers who were there, and I was talking to exhibitors, and so I've got lots of notes and lots of ideas on what needs to be sort of changed. We're going up on the heath, on Lednam Heath, on the light land, big open fields, fairly flat, easy draining soil, so all that just makes things a little bit easier.
So get that in your diary, 11th and 12th of June 2025, cereals in Lincolnshire. Can't wait. Cheers, Andrew.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
The Farming Programme.
Market reports.
Starting as usual with livestock from Louth Market auctioneer Ed Middleton. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. This week, heifers topped for JNS Brooks of Strubby at £1,786.05, or 289.5 pence per kilo. In the bulls, our Rain Sons Limited of Boothby Graffo topped at £1,660.80, or 259.5 pence per kilo. Onto the cult and OTM cattle, top price this week came from Jenny Thilby of Kexby at 190.5 pence per kilo, or £1,489.90. And they averaged 172.6 pence per kilo. Onto the sheep, super entry of prime lambs this week with an SQQ of 393.7 pence per kilo and an all-in average pounds per head of £170.89. Top price this week came from D.A. Barker of Althorp at £195 with a run of 32 lambs, averaging a super £178. Onto the hogs, an SQQ this week of 292.85 pence per kilo and an all-in average of £126.76. A very mixed bag of hogs this week, as you would expect for the time of year, with pretty much every breed imaginable in the mix. Topping the hogs this week with W.H. Farrow and Sons of Strubby at £177. Onto the cull ewes, an average this week of £116.71. Again, similar to the hogs, a very mixed bag of ewes. A lot of thin lambing type ewes forward. A lot of plain ewes proved probably difficult to sell this week. J.M. Robinson and Sons of Great Limber topped the ewes at £200 for a super Suffolk ewe. And Scrooby Farms Limited of Horncastle sold ewes to £162. Reminder, it's Stork Cattle Week tomorrow. We look forward to seeing you then with all prime cattle, cool cattle and all classes of sheep. I'm Edwin Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Ed. And taking a look at the grain markets this week, Open Fields, Alice Killam. Morning, Alice.
Good morning, Steve. Very sadly, Tuesday night's uplift was not held onto on Wednesday morning. We lost most of what we gained by 10 a.m. as the focus switched to Wednesday's USDA numbers, which in truth weren't that exciting. No fireworks, the rest of the week has been slow and steady, which is not something we've seen for a while. Old crop sellers are finding that old crop buyers have disappeared, so this is making the selling of the old crop difficult. The good news, new crop gives us a carry, and I don't think we're going to see an early harvest, so we're not doomed yet. To the USDA report, a shifting around with numbers, I think, is the best description of what has happened. As expected, the wheat production was dropped, mainly Russia, though some would argue that this was not enough. But this was counteracted by a larger stock, which they carried over from last year. How convenient. Corn numbers, which I think will become more important as next season develops, were again just fiddled around with at the edges. The real conundrum is what happens from here. Russia is clearly a problem. Some analysts argue that the USDA have not gone far enough in their downgrades, and it's hard to disagree with this sentiment. Their old crop export numbers are strong, so perhaps they're not carrying as much forward as originally thought. There was a big spike on Tuesday afternoon as news of the problems in the Rostov region were documented, but since then, nothing. It's like a ticking time bomb. You're not sure if or when it'll go off. But for the moment, at least, the market is not looking at this at all. It is choosing to look at the stocks in the US and the fund managers who are choosing to sell their positions once again to create their short. Nobody is currently concerned about the potential issues in India as they become importers, not exporters, or China, who are looking at hot and dry conditions to support their next record crop. This, be under no doubt, is why the market has tumbled again so quickly. UK-wise, we have been caught up in all of this, of course. We will react to global markets, and ultimately we are pricing new crop against the next cheapest commodity. If the alternative comes down in price, then so do we. With an election around the corner and another Bank of England meeting this time next week, lots of things could happen, but I think the commodity that we're going to need to track in the coming months is corn. I've heard about domestic buyers already entering the market to purchase new crop corn over the last couple of days. In fairness, the spread has come in a little. Corn was very cheap, but this is what I can see as being beaten up with in the early part of next season. It perhaps indicates a cheaper feed grain price, but corn doesn't make very good bread. Could we see these multi-year high premiums widen out further? There are lots of unanswered questions on the new crop for me. Cheap corn will come in, but we'll hopefully have our chance. And as somebody reminded me yesterday, we don't have our crop yet. Some sun would be very, very welcome. Some prices for this week, circa Friday morning. Feed wheat, July, 180 to 190. September, 195 to 205. May, 205 to 215. Feed barley, July, 150 to 160. September, 165 to 175. And May, 175 to 185. All seed rape, July, 355 to 365. August, 370 to 380. And November, 380 to 390.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
Well, summer is postponed for another week. Rain around most days, not a lot of sunshine or wind, and what there is will be mostly southwesterly. Temperature highs in the mid-teens Celsius. Well, that's it for the Farming Programme podcast for this week. More from cereals next week and a look at quad bike safety. And I look forward to seeing you at the Lincolnshire Show on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm Steve Orchard. Until then, have a great week.
The Farming Programme with Araquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, BSI ISO 9001 accredited.